The views and comments expressed on the Space Show by its guests, callers, and listeners belong to them. The Space Show and its hosts serve only as a platform and are not responsible for others' comments or views. All topics discussed on the Space Show are primarily for educational purposes.
We choose to go to the moon in this decade and do the other thing.
Not because they are easy, but
we
because
have main engine start. 4, 3, 2, 1.
It's the Space Show with Dr. David Livingston. Broadcasting to 7 continents, consistently bringing you quality news and interviews with the best and brightest minds in the new space economy. Here is the founder and host of the Space Show, the man who best articulates the vision of space commercial enterprise, Dr. David Livingston.
Good morning, listeners. Welcome to our Friday morning California time Space Show program. I am your host, David Livingston. Thank you all for tuning in. And let's get right down to business, as they say. For those of you that are able to use your telephone to call in and talk with our guest today, the toll-free number is 1-866-687-7223. And please remember there are no call screeners, so just be patient and we'll answer and bring you up on air as quickly as we possibly can. You can also use email, drspace@thespaceshow.com, and you can also communicate with us via our Space Show blog. So to do that, go to our home site, homepage, thespaceshow.com. All the way over on the right side, look for the upcoming show menu. And this program should be the number one program in upcoming shows. And then you open that page. That is our archive page once the show is archived. But if you scroll all the way down, you'll come to the comment section. And feel free to post a comment or a question. We will pick it up almost immediately and be able to bring it to the attention of our guest. So, again, visit our homepage, thespaceshow.com. There is a very detailed website newsletter there. You'll see it right center, and that is updated every Sunday afternoon after the Space Show program. So it's current for the week. It has all of the comprehensive details for the week's programming. Plus, if you scroll down, it has all of the planned events for the Space Show, and right now we're booking the latter part of the first quarter of 2017. Everything we do is archived, and you can listen right off of the web page. Very easy to do that. And you can also download the shows if you prefer to do that. If you go to the upper left menu, there is an instruction there called Listen Live, and that tells you how to both listen to a live show as well as to listen to an archive show. And then on every archive page, there's a button underneath the recording that says download, and you should be able to pick up that show on your whatever device you're using very, very quickly, especially if you have high-speed internet. We're using a different format these days, so a typical 90-minute Space Show program is maybe 12 to 14 megabytes. So everything we do is archived, and as I said, you can listen very quickly off of our website or easily download the show. There is a store in that upper left menu, and that's under the support menu item. And if you're interested in Space Show t-shirts, coffee mugs, things of that nature, that's where you will find them. So hopefully you will find some items of interest for you there. The most important button to me is the Support the Space Show button. Again, look center right on the Space Show website. And we are a 501c3 nonprofit with one, O-N-E, GiantLeapFoundation.org. And we are able to bring you these programs because many of you do financially help support the Space Show. As a 501c3 nonprofit, if you pay U.S. taxes, you do get a tax deduction for your gift. And the same is true for those of you paying California taxes. We're known as a California Public Benefit Corporation. And again, your gifts do allow us to continue these programs, and that's not an understatement. So we really appreciate your support. visit oneonegiantleapfoundation.org if you have any questions or you want additional information about our parent nonprofit corporation. Or, of course, you can email me at drspace@thespaceshow.com. We do have sponsors that are helping us out, too, and we definitely appreciate our sponsors. And they are a key part of the Space Show being able to bring you these programs. I suggest you look at their banner ads that go across the homepage from time to time. They rotate in sequence. And, again, we're very appreciative of our sponsors. And the first segment is brought to you by three of our sponsors. So the Space Finance Group is a team of space advocates, and they have crowdfunding expertise. Many of the team have helped raise over $1 million in crowdfunding, and they would like to help you raise the funds you need to get your space project going. If your space idea can be moved forward for under $250,000, crowdfunding might be the ideal solution for you. We're the only crowdfunding team that specializes in space projects. We understand space. We're the people behind the Integrated Space Plan, for example, and we understand the audience you need to reach. Visit us online at thespacefinancegroup.com. That's all one word. You can also send them an email at jay.witner@spacefinancegroup.com. And remember, no bucks, no Buck Rogers. And then also, we appreciate the Space Foundation. They are a sponsor, and they have their 33rd Space Symposium coming up, and they say attend the 33rd Space Symposium, make prosperous connections, hear timely critical dialogue, and engage with the global space industry. It's April 3rd through the 6th in Colorado Springs. Their website for reservations and all the information, spacesymposium.org. One more sponsor for the first segment is Orbital ATK, the global leader in aerospace and defense technology. They are known as the partner you can count on for advanced, reliable space propulsion systems and for space exploration, commercial ventures, and defense programs. We definitely appreciate our sponsors. We thank them very much for helping the Space Show do what it does. And today I'm happy to bring back to the program Rex Ridenour, and he is the head of Ecliptic Enterprises Corporation, and they're located in the Pasadena area, that's Southern California. And Rex has been on the show many, many times, so many of you are familiar with him. But Ecliptic is a 16-year-old privately held space avionics and sensor systems firm. And Rex is responsible for Ecliptic's financial results and for coordinating the firm's overall corporate strategy, business development partnering, and branding initiatives. He also helps shape R&D planning and selectively contributes to various technical contracts. They are the world's leading supplier of rugged video systems used on rockets and spacecraft. It's known as the Rocket Cam product family, and we've talked about that on many, many different space show programs. They also produce space avionics for control and data handling of scientific payloads. I could go on and on and on and read about the company as well as Rex, but I would rather you read about him when you can on the Space Show website, because his full bio, updated bio, is listed there. We have a lot to talk about with Rex today, so I'd rather talk with him rather than read about him. And Rex, welcome back to the Space Show. How are you, my friend, and Happy New Year to you.
Yeah, Happy New Year to you too, David. Pleasure to be on the show again. Good morning.
What's new with Ecliptic for 2017? The last time we talked, you were getting ready to do the light sail experiment with the I'm having a senior moment with the Planetary Society. So where are you today? That's a little bit more than a year ago you were on the show.
Yeah, it was actually a year and a half ago, we had just finished the light sail A mission. It was called Light Sail A back then. Now it's called Light Sail 1 by the Planetary Society. But that was in May, June of 2015, and I think I was on in July. So basically, for the last 18 months, we've been really, really, really busy, and I'll go through what on. But to kind of start with the generalities, you know, as you mentioned, we're 16 years old. We'll be 16 actually in 3 weeks from now, March 1st. And we ended last year in a very good position. We had almost record backlog, which is firm contract work to do. We had almost record cash in the bank, and we certainly had record prospects for new business that we were chasing. So we're pretty well set up for a good year this year. Last year was our, in 16 years of business, last year was our fourth best year for sales, which is just bringing in contracts, you know, the bookings.
Uh-huh.
So that's a good way to end the year. Starting this year on January 3rd, we brought on another employee, and so we became our largest size ever in staff. We've never been larger than 11, but now we're at 12. And we actually have two contractors working here as well, so you might count that as 14.
Are you hiring at all or taking on interns or anything like that?
We are planning in our forecast for this year, we're actually planning to hire at least two more people, yeah. And it depends a little bit on what kind of work we win, but we do plan on being bigger, yes.
Okay.
We also, last week, we signed a lease in the same business park that we're in to expand our facilities by about 30% because of the work we have coming in. And that's the first time we've ever expanded our offices down here in Pasadena since we started. We have had an office for 10 years up at the NASA Ames area in the Moffett Research Park, like a lot of other new space companies are up there as well, like Made in Space, Astra Digital, those kind of firms, MoonX. But we have an office up in the Silicon Valley as well. But down here, we actually expanded for the first time ever. We also, I can get into this later, but over the last 5 years or so, we've spun off two other companies that were initially, the projects were started in-house, and we felt like they would be a distraction to our core space business, so we spun them out as separate little LLC companies, and those two are very active as well, and Ecliptic is a co-owner of each, so I can describe those later. So anyway, we've got a lot of things turning, lots of activity. Right now we have 14 active contracts, almost all of which involve flight hardware. As you mentioned, we're a space avionics and sensor systems firm, and we are totally focused on producing products that go on rockets and spacecraft. And so, as you can imagine, with now 12 people in the building, a couple of which don't really do the technical work, that leaves about 10 people that are working on 14 active contracts. That means everybody's really busy. So it's a good problem to have, better than the alternate.
Who are the major users of your rocket cam system? Is it NASA, or where do people see it when they're watching rocket launches?
Well, it's changed a little bit over time. Early on, we were only on Atlas and Delta rockets and a couple of Titan IVs. Then we started on Shuttle. And then after the Columbia accident, which was caused by falling foam, we became standard on all the shuttles till the end of the program, so you saw a lot of shuttle launches with our stuff. Over the years, we've been on some Minotaur launches, the first two Antares launches from Orbital, their new rocket. And the way I put it now is we've basically been on all the rockets in the U.S. except for SpaceX and some of the brand new ones like Blue Origin. But we've been on quite a few others. So over the life of this rocket cam product family, we've had our systems on 110 rockets and on 30 different spacecraft. And three of those spacecraft went all the way to the moon. We have always had a goal to be on a Mars mission, but we haven't gone all the way to Mars yet, but we've been at least to the moon three times. What people see nowadays is that we're on every Cygnus cargo vehicle that goes to space station that's built by Orbital ATK. We're on a whole series of target rockets that launch targets for the Missile Defense Agency to practice with. And those are almost never in the news, but we've been on probably a couple of dozen of those. And they're all suborbital launches, but they have lots of sensors on board. They're watching these impacts of target practice. And that's a very regular business for us, but we've never even seen the video ourselves. That's how under the radar these missions are, but that's a good base of business for us. We, as people may have followed a year and a half ago, we were on the LightSail spacecraft. There were some cameras on there, and LightSail 2, which is coming up probably by the end of the year or early next year, will also have cameras. We count those as part of the mix.
What about foreign launchers? Are you on any foreign launchers?
No, I was going to mention that later. We have never had a significant sale of our systems to any foreign rocket or spacecraft program, but there is a fairly large one in the works that I can get into later. So we're chasing that one pretty hard. But frankly, until the last couple of years, the ITAR regulations made it almost not worth our while to even try to chase that business.
Have they been streamlined now?
Yeah, they have, and I actually just last Sunday submitted a request for clarification from the Department of State to tell us one way or the other whether we're under the ITAR rules or not anymore. And I kind of, when I read the rules, I kind of conclude myself that we're not, and that maybe we can just export commercially. So we should get a judgment on that before the end of February. So, so the way we split our business up is we have this core rocket cam business, which for about the first 10 years of the company was essentially 100% of our business. Now it's only about two-thirds of our business in terms of sales and revenue. And we're on rockets, we're on spacecraft, we go to suborbital space, you know, up to orbit, we go all the way out to the moon, and we're hoping to go to Mars someday. But the kind of projects we're working on there are, we still have regular orders for the Cygnus cargo vehicles, regular orders for these target rockets that the Missile Defense Agency funds. We have regular orders from both commercial and government agencies for geosynchronous satellites, where we're on board those to watch antenna deployments and solar panel deployments. And then I mentioned this foreign sale that could be coming. That's going to cover several systems for both low Earth orbiting satellites and geo satellites.
What about planetary missions, the stuff that goes to Mars or Pluto or, you know, maybe the future Europa mission? Do you get on
those?
Yeah,
we've been on three lunar missions, the LCROSS Lunar Impactor in 2009 and also the two GRAIL spacecraft that orbited the moon and mapped the lunar gravity. Those are the three lunar missions we've been on. We've been written into several proposals for CubeSats that go to the moon, asteroids, and Mars, but none of those proposals have won yet. And so we're still hoping to be on a CubeSat or two with our video systems. But we typically don't compete for the more exquisite scientific imagers like you would have on a mission to Jupiter or to Mars. That's not really our niche. But if it's context video or situational awareness video, we try to chase those missions. If you sort of upgrade our systems, the core rocket cam systems, which typically is a complete subsystem that has a fairly sophisticated avionics unit controlling one or more sensors. If you take those sensors away and just if you keep the sensors but you add more software to the avionics unit to process some of those images and do things with them, we can be a subsystem that supports in-orbit servicing and rendezvous and proximity operations for, like, vehicles that are docking with space station and maybe vehicles someday that are docking with other spacecraft to service them. And so we, for several years now, we've been embedded in this very ambitious robotic servicing demonstration program that Goddard is running on the space station called the Robotic Refueling Mission. I believe they're in their third phase now, and we've supplied cameras for all phases. And that's been very successful, showing what you can do with robotically assisted tools that are up. In this case, they're operated from the ground at Goddard, but they're doing some very impressive spacecraft servicing operations, and our video cameras are typically providing the situational awareness video for what's going on up there. We also just learned last week that we're going to probably have a piece of the rendezvous and proximity operations system for a commercial in-orbit servicing program. And I can't talk about it much, but we believe we're going to get a piece of that. That's interesting. If you take our electronics and basically remove the sensors and just see what you can do with the electronics, that's where a lot of our growth in the business has come from lately, the last few years. And what you end up with is what's termed as either a payload controller or a payload sequencer, a payload data handler, or just a hosted payload controller. It's basically a electronics unit that isolates a lot of the complexity that you would need to operate a payload or multiple payloads on a rocket or a spacecraft and keep that complexity away from the flight computer that's on the rocket or spacecraft and instead put it in our unit and let our unit handle all of that complexity and all the data handling, all the formatting, and isolate all of that. It makes it easier to integrate with the host platform. It makes it easier to test before you mate the two together. There's all kinds of advantages. So a prototypical example of this application is what we did on LCROSS, which was the NASA Lunar Impactor mission, trying to impact an upper stage of a rocket into a southern polar crater on the moon, lift up the dirt into the sun, and then a follow-on spacecraft that was previously attached to that rocket followed it in shortly after impact and measured all of this material coming up from the crater floor. And there were nine sensors on that spacecraft watching this big plume of material come up from the lunar surface. And eight of those sensors were scientific sensors. One was our video camera, a rocket cam video camera. And our avionics controlled all of those sensors instead of having the flight computer on the spacecraft do that. And so we were part of the payload, the scientific payload. We controlled everything, all the sequencing, all the data handling, all the formatting, and passed all of that data to the spacecraft flight computer for downlink back to Earth. So architecturally, that's what we're doing with these things. Examples of what we're working on now, we just finished a couple months ago a similar unit that would be controlling a very ambitious experiment that's going up on Space Station this summer. And it will be a very complicated deployment of a mechanical system. I can't describe it by name yet, but you'll hear about it later this summer. And we're controlling the entire deployment of this system. We're taking video of the deployment. We're going to shake the system as it's deployed, get some vibration data, collect all of that, that information, and then format it and pass it back down through the space station back to Earth. We also finished last year a preliminary design for automating some experiments that are on the inside of space station with similar electronics like I just described. We finished the preliminary design, but then events sort of overcame our customer, and they decided not to go ahead with the actual flight hardware. But for a while, we were on the hook to build 32 of these systems. But we didn't get that flight order. And they're not going to do it at all, actually, but it was an interesting project. And so those are kind of experiment controllers. For sequencers, we're on two contracts right now, which will control the deployment of secondary payloads off rockets. And as people that follow this know, more and more small satellites and CubeSats are clumping together on rockets, bigger rockets. And some of these rockets are scheduled to deploy dozens of spacecraft in one shot. And to do those deployments, you need a sequencer that can time out everything, actuate all the actuations that are required to kick these small satellites off the rocket and maybe even capture context video as they're going off. And that's what these systems do that we're producing. So we have one contract that we're doing not only the sequencers, and they'll be redundant, which means, you know, two of everything, but it turns out the harness to connect to all of the deployment devices is hideously complicated, and we actually got that job as well. So we're doing the harness for all that. And that's one of the reasons we needed the extra space in our offices is because the harness is going to be so complicated, we needed a special lab just to lay it out and make sure it's built up the right way.
You have a question. Let me bring it into you. John is in Dallas, Texas, and he says, are you mostly making one off of each of these items, or do they get mass produced? And if they're mass produced, are you using foreign manufacturing?
I wouldn't call it mass produced, but three of our programs, we're in the build of, we're well over 10 systems, which for us is a lot. And we tend to get orders in clumps of, you know, 2 to 3 to 6, maybe 8 at a time. These are complete systems, you know, electronics and sensors. They take months to produce and test. And we have several programs that are in those recurring order phases now. A lot of our customers just order one or two of things, and that's all we hear from them. So there's nothing like mass production in our business, but there is some production, and none of it is overseas. It's all right here in Pasadena. And the production quantities just aren't even high enough to even think about going somewhere else to produce it, frankly. So that's what we do. Another going back to those payload controllers and sequencers, another one we're doing on a rocket is that they're everybody's familiar with the ESPA ring, which is a standard interface adapter for small satellites and CubeSat carriers and things like that. We're on one of those ESPA rings to deploy a CubeSat out of a container that's going to be on there, and there may be more than one of those. And those will be a recurring order as well, because they have more launches scheduled of these things. So that all of that stuff is sort of our core business. That's probably about 80% of our business right now, these rocket cam systems and the controllers and sequencers. Turns out about 5 years ago, we had an opportunity to shrink our electronics down a notch because of Moore's Law and all of that. And we purposely chose to make all of our electronics CubeSat sized because it just made sense at the time. This was in 2009. So fairly quickly, all of our customers over about 2 years switched over from our bigger electronics to these smaller ones. And so we're only producing CubeSat class electronics now. We thought that would open up some opportunities to do CubeSat business, CubeSat-related stuff, and it did. So we were selected to be the prime contractor for LightSail from the Planetary Society. We hit that first mission pretty hard the last time I was on the show, so I won't go through that again. But we had a second mission to finish the spacecraft and test it, get it ready for launch. We just finished that literally weeks ago. It's now sitting at Cal Poly San Luis Obispo for some final software checkout, and it will be stuffed into its T-Pod carrier deployer system in a few weeks. The pre-ship review is in March, and it'll be shipped to another spacecraft project that was built and coordinated out of Georgia Tech called PROX-1. And PROX-1 is a proximity operations testbed spacecraft, if you will, funded by the Air Force. And to do proximity operations, that usually means you need a target to dance around with one spacecraft, you know, maneuvering around another. And they needed a target, and it turns out LightSail 2 is going to be their target. And so for a few weeks, they'll use us as a target, and then after we deploy from them, and then once they're done, they will back off, set up their cameras to take some exquisite images of LightSail 2 deploying its solar sail, and then the two missions will become separate. So that was pretty satisfying to finish all of that work. There were a lot of lessons learned on LightSail 1, and those are incorporated into LightSail 2. Another CubeSat-related job that we just finished is with JPL, and they're building an astronomy spacecraft, a 6U CubeSat, that will do, if you can believe this, it's a demonstration spacecraft to show that you can detect planets around other stars with a 6U CubeSat. And we had a job to interface their camera that they wanted to use, their imaging camera, with the flight computer on the spacecraft. And so we built a circuit card that interfaced the two, and we got all that working. We just finished that. I think they might launch later this year, but I'm not sure about that. We also finished a couple of high-definition camera jobs, one for a university and one for a private company that want to put a high-definition, very small, high-definition camera inside of their CubeSats. And we made sales to both of those groups. We have a small high-definition camera that's almost like the size of your camera in your cell phone. And we believe it'll work pretty well on a space-based application. We've, in the last 18 months or so, we've been written into several proposals for CubeSats where our video systems basically and our control electronics would be in CubeSats going to the moon and Mars and asteroids. But so far, none of those proposals have been selected by NASA. So we're not on any of them yet. But
are you on any of the Google Lunar XPRIZE launches, so to speak?
No, but back in 2008, we were on one of the teams. I was going to mention that later. It was called Southern California Selene Group, based here in Southern California. And at the time they were active, they were considered the leading team of all of them. There were like 20 teams at the time. And our video systems were going to be on that mission. And I was the deputy project manager as well. But I want to mention that later, maybe after the break, what happened to that. So anyway, we're kind of in the queue. We're being considered to be a CubeSat production company for some customers that want to use CubeSats, but they don't want to build up their own infrastructure to produce them. So we've been approached by at least three companies so far to be a candidate for their production house, and hoping to get one of those jobs someday. So those are sort of the four core categories of our business. And just to recap, it's the core rocket cam business. It's sort of an enhanced rocket cam system that we call our rendezvous and proximity operations or in-orbit servicing system. We do payload control and sequencing, data handling, hosted payloads, all of that, and then this CubeSat-related stuff. We always have a few projects that are kind of cooking on the back burner called advanced programs. Most companies have these, and these are just nifty ideas that we hope someday will turn into real business. And we have four of those that are in various states of activity. One came out of this Google Lunar XPRIZE effort in 2008, and it's a unique architecture for landers that could land on basically any planetary surface or moon. Called a spinning lander. It was developed by Harold Rosen, who used to be the chief technical officer for Hughes Space and Communications. He's one of the giants in the space industry. He led the team that put the first commercial, the first geosynchronous satellite up in orbit back in the early 60s. And unfortunately, he just passed away this past Monday at age 90.
Right, I saw the announcements. He was a guest on the show a couple of times.
Yeah, he's just
ago.
A brilliant guy, stellar career, really nice person, and sorry to see him go, but this was his idea back in the early 60s, a spinning lander. He's the guy and his team, they figured out most of the physics and engineering related to spinning spacecraft back in the 60s. Completely dominated the industry all the way through the 80s. And I worked on some of those programs early in my career, but anyway, after he shut down his Google Lunar XPRIZE team in 2008, the spinning lander concept was patented by that time, or patent pending, I should say, and he signed it over to Ecliptic to take it and run with it. So we control that patent now, and we're trying to turn it into something useful. So just a few months ago, NASA Goddard submitted a proposal to NASA for funding to investigate how the spinning lander concept could be used as a small satellite concept for planetary missions and planetary landers and moon landers in particular. So they did not get funded, but it was nice to be included in a proposal like that. Another effort we have is years ago we developed a system that was derived from our camera pods that are on the outsides of rockets. on a regular basis. We enlarged that pod design and made it big enough to accommodate a single CubeSat, a 1U CubeSat. And so this concept became what we call Rocket Pod. Instead of Rocket Cam, it's Rocket Pod. And we did that design with Cal Poly San Luis Obispo, which, as many of our listeners know, was behind the design for the P-Pod, which is sort of a standard payload carrier system for CubeSats, carrier deployer system. Rather than compete with our partners, we let them run with the P-Pod, and that became very successful. We didn't really market the Rocket Pod much, but it's still a very unique way to get payloads into space by riding on the outside of a rocket, or otherwise enclosing them in a little pod that has a lot of privacy. So that's kind of sitting on the back burner. We're not really marketing it that hard, but it's a nifty little system. We have one sensor that we're working with an inventor on that's very unique, called the remote acoustic sensor, and that's very active right now. And what it is it's a sensor that converts light to sound in real time over any distance, from microscopic to astronomical distances. So if you listen to microscopic creatures under the microscope with this, you can hear them because of the light that flickers into this sensor. And it's amazing what you can hear. If you had a CubeSat in Earth orbit looking at the sun with the right field of view and the right filters, you would hear the sun boil based on the light that you're seeing from the sun. So what we're doing right now is doing lots of ground testing, watching rocket launches and rocket motor firings, characterizing what this system does. But we've been able to track rockets from as far as 200 miles away from the ground, and you can hear all the events on board the rocket because of the light that's coming out of the back end of the rocket. And if it's a daytime launch, the sun glinting off the skin of the rocket. So you hear first stage shutdown, you hear second stage startup, you hear thruster firings as they're reorienting the stage, things like that. So we have this is quickly transitioning into a real business for us, because we did get our first sale of one of these sensor systems last August, and we're expecting more. And we hope to later this year, get this system on a rocket or maybe even on a spacecraft and actually listen to what happens as you go up to orbit or once you're in orbit. And it's really, really interesting.
You have another email. Josh is in Albuquerque, New Mexico, and he says there seems to be a whole bunch of new small rockets being built to carry over for the CubeSat industry. Are you in contact with any of these companies? Will Rocket Cam be recording any of these new small launchers once they come online?
It's a good question. There's, last count from the Small Satellite Conference last year, there's somewhere around 30 of these companies around the world, or I should say 30 rocket programs under development that are all trying to address getting more small sats and CubeSats into orbit. So that's a lot of companies to keep track of. I've talked to probably two-thirds of them, and we've actually submitted proposals to several. Right now, we're not on contract with any of them, but one of the reasons for that is most of these companies are still trying to focus on getting their rocket design done, you know, their engines, their airframe, their electronics. The few we've submitted proposals to have matured enough along those lines that now they can start thinking about some of the auxiliary kind of nice-to-have systems, which would include video. Not all of them want video, but most of them are interested in that. Quite a few of them actually are kind of following the SpaceX example, and they're trying to vertically integrate. So they're generally not trying to get suppliers from outside their company. They're just doing it themselves. And I think that's happened to at least three of the companies that I'm aware of that we've written proposals to. They finally decided just to do it themselves. So no, we haven't been on any of those. We don't have any contracts for them, but I'd sure like to once, clearly not all 30 are going to succeed. So we tend to wait till the carnage happens and we start talking to the ones that are still alive. And we'll cycle back once the herd is cold a little bit and there's some more serious firms to talk with.
Well, that may be later this year, because some of those firms are launching the Google Lunar XPRIZE rocket programs.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
We'll see if any of them.
Some of these firms have already started going out of business, or at least they've gone out of the launcher business, like X-Core. You know, they're not out of business, but they're not building, you know, the Lynx anymore, as far as I know. So.
As far as I know too, they laid off their Lynx.
Going to be supplying high definition video for them eventually. That was a discussion we had, but that's kind of moved. So.
Do you do that?
There's a lot of activity going on, but who knows how it's all going to turn out.
Well, a lot of patience, right?
Yeah, right. It's a very, very frothy environment right now. Let me just finish off one more thing, and then I'm kind of done with our company description. In the advanced programs area, I mentioned earlier that we had spun off two companies. Those used to be advanced programs, and we decided that they didn't fit the core space business, so we spun them off as separate companies, and both of those are pretty active. One is one is a company that is actually going to be heavily involved with a hosted payload series that we think is going to get funded soon, and they'll be coordinating that. And it's many dozens of sensors that would be in orbit to capture some data from Earth orbit and turn it into a business. And Ecliptic will do the hardware, but the spinoff that we started a few years ago will actually run the program for the customer. The other one is a strange little project that we sort of inherited by chance, by just contacts in the industry, and it's a geologic sounding device that can detect something valuable under the ground, and it looks like it looks intriguing enough that we think we're going to get some funding to make a prototype of this thing. It actually was working years ago, and it was put in storage. Now it's working again. We're trying to refine its operation and turn it into a business, but that's a separate company as well. I won't go into that here because it has nothing to do with space. But anyway, that's kind of what we're involved with, very active. Unfortunately, a lot of our customers will not let us even mention what project we're on with them. In a few cases, we don't even know what the project is. We just have a sale. So I'm sorry for not mentioning more detail on some of these, but in many cases, we just can't because of our non-disclosure agreement.
Is that because of security or because of afraid of competition?
A little bit of both. Usually, if it's a commercial company, it's because they just don't want their competitors to know what they're up to in detail. If it's a government-funded program, especially one of the defense-oriented government agencies, it's more for security, and that's just the way they operate.
Have you had any interactions yet with anyone representing the new Trump administration?
No. I've talked just this morning. I was on the phone with someone who visited with their beachhead team earlier this week, and I got some feedback from him on what he experienced. But I know a few of those people on that team, including Alan Stern and Chaz Miller. You know, I know those two, but I don't talk to them about this. I haven't. What I learn about all that is on your show, David.
Were his experiences positive, the person you talked to earlier today?
Yeah. Yeah, he said his general impression was they're kind of skewed more toward the commercial and private model of doing space versus the government model. That was his general impression, which is what I expected when you look at the makeup of that team. Plus, Trump himself is sort of more of a businessman than a government guy.
Yeah, for sure.
But, you know, like I've heard on your show probably 10 times since the elections, you know, who knows what he's going to do next?
Well, boy, you can say that again.
I'm not even going to comment on that. every day opening the news is another surprise.
There's no boredom, regardless of what you may think. That is for sure.
Yeah.
You want to take a pause here? We're at the halfway point, and we'll come back with the second part of the show.
If it's that time, sure.
It is already that time. So,
wow.
Listeners, I want you to stay put, and we'll be back with Rex in a couple of minutes. Our toll-free number for those of you that can access your phones, if you're not listening at work, for example, 1-866-687-7223. Email remains, DrSpace, DrSpace, at thespaceshow.com. And then you can also post comments on our blog for this show. Again, go to thespaceshow.com. Upcoming show menu on the far right side. This is the first show. Open up the archive page and then comment to your heart's galore down at the bottom of the page. So everybody sit tight. We'll be back with Rex and more in about 3 minutes.
The Space Show thanks its listeners for their generous support. The Space Show now joins forces with the One Giant Leap Foundation to further advance space education and the establishment of a spacefaring society and culture in America and the world. One Giant Leap Foundation is a tax-exempt organization with the purpose of advancing space education and development along with The Space Show. Your support of The Space Show and One Giant Leap Foundation helps get the word out as to why space is so essential and important to us all. So join with us by going to www.thespaceshow.com and clicking on the Support The Space Show button. Your contribution will help The Space Show and One Giant Leap Foundation in continuing its work and bringing you the programming you want free of charge on a continued basis. And remember, your gift to The Space Show is tax deductible.
Welcome back, everybody. This is part two of our Friday Space Show program, and I am your host, David Livingston. Our guest today, Rex Ridenour, he's CEO and co-founder of Ecliptic Enterprises Corporation. That's in Pasadena, with an office also around the NASA Ames area in Silicon Valley. And we have two sponsors for the second part of our program. So AIAA, the American Institute of Aeronautics and Astronautics, is the world's largest aerospace professional society. They have more than 30,000 engineers and scientists from 88 countries dedicated to the global aerospace profession. They convene 5 yearly forums or conferences. They publish books, tech journals, and Aerospace America magazine. They host a collection of more than 150,000 technical AIAA papers. They also develop and maintain standards, honors, and celebrate achievement with key people and advocate space policy issues. AIAA serves the aerospace professionals around the world, and it helps shape the future of aerospace by providing tools, insights, and collaborative exchanges to advance the state of art in aerospace engineering and science. Check them out at AIAA.org. And Celestis is also a sponsor, and they are the pioneer leader, global leader of Memorial Spaceflight Services. They've been around since 1995, and they have a new Celestis DNA service. Since 1997, Celestis Memorial Spaceflights have flown people's ashes into space, providing uniquely compelling post-cremation memorial services, and now they offer the opportunity to fly your DNA into the final frontier. Thanks to the Celestis partnership with CG Labs of Canada, which is a world leader in DNA collection and home storage for consumers, Celestis expands personal spaceflight options beyond memorial services to everyone on the planet today. The new service also stores your DNA off-planet through Celestis Lunar and deep space missions, and provides you a kit you can use to store your DNA at home. Families that choose traditional burial can fly their deceased loved ones' DNA on Celestis missions. Moreover, families that choose, also people can send the living family member's DNA along with their deceased family member's person on a DNA flight with Celestis as well. So you can get a lot more information, and that is at Celestis.com. They're a great company to do business with, and I am their customer for several flights. And as you've heard me say many times on the Space Show, I love these people. They're really wonderful to deal with, and I know it can be a touchy, sensitive topic. But they make the process very, very easy and very, very meaningful. So, again, Celestis.com. Rex, you're almost 16 years old, and the Space Show will be 16 years old, and I guess our first space program was around June 1st, although we started the actual radio broadcast in mid-May of 2001. What's it like doing an actual space hardware and electronics engineering firm? How has that changed over 16 years?
I love to talk about this topic because at most conferences you go to and other events, there's a lot of talk about how to start a startup, how to get investments for your startup, you know, how to write your pitch, you know, all this stuff related to coming up with a great idea, getting funding, and starting a company. There's very little discussion at most of the places I go about, let's say you've done that and you've succeeded for a year or two, then what happens? You know, what happens after you've sort of gotten through startup phase, but you're still a small company and you need to go somewhere with it? You know, what do? That's what I've been going through the last, let's call it last 15 years. Our startup phase was actually relatively smooth. And one reason for that is we started with 11 people from scratch in 2001. And we had all been working in a company right before that, just 6 weeks before that got shut down, that had 50 people. And it was also a relatively new space company. And so we all knew each other, we worked well together, and we kind of all jointly came up with the idea for what this company would be in record time. We had an angel investor who is still our only investor. He's still our chairman, and he's the one that sort of defined what he wanted to hear. And if we met all of his criteria, we would get funding. And we did all of that in 3 weeks. And then 3 weeks later, we literally opened our doors for business. So the whole process took 6 weeks. And the last time we ever got any funding from this guy was 2003. So we've basically been on our own for 13 years. And so we've learned a few things along the way. As I mentioned, the startup phase, I think it's a little bit unusual. We actually had a very smooth startup phase. The trouble started about a year later when we were coming into early 2002, and we were still kind of chewing on some fairly large contracts we won right when we started, and those were starting to come to an end. And so we were chasing other sources of business that we sort of naively just assumed it was going to happen just because the customer was telling us it was going to happen. And so we sort of let our guard down. We weren't doing business development aggressively enough. And in 1 week, both of the biggest prospects we were chasing disappeared. And so we went from thinking we were going to have a record year in 2002 to wondering if we're going to survive the summer. So we ended up laying off about a third of the company, you know, completely hunkering down. That's when we had to go back for more cash from our investor between 2002 and 2003. You know, very painful. And so a couple lessons I learned there were that lesson number one is what everybody hears about running a business of any size, which is never run out of cash. That's like rule number one no matter what. The second rule we learned is never, ever run out of cash. You never want to run out of cash because it gets very painful in a hurry. And rule number three is that no matter how rosy you think things are or will be, you can't ever stop marketing your company, your business, your projects. You always have to be marketing, trying to get more work in the door, no matter what. And that's the big lesson we learned from 2002, is that we just weren't doing that aggressively enough. So from then on, that was a very big priority. The way we model our company, and it seems to work pretty well, is that you've got a small team that worries only about getting business in the door. That's new contracts, sales, all that stuff. You have another team, which is most of our company, which actually does the work, and that generates invoices, which then customers pay, and that's what generates the cash. We have one guy who's our CFO who deals with collecting on those invoices and making sure that the customer pays. And as many small business owners appreciate, sometimes your customers aren't that prompt about paying, and if you let them get away with it too often, you can actually go out of business just because you lose your source of cash, which is getting paid. And believe it or not, that's a big problem for a lot of companies. And we set the tone very early with our customers to not let that happen. So when customers start acting flaky like that and they start violating the terms of the contract, we are super aggressive about making sure that they pay. And we've even used threats of, we know most of the time in a lot of these big companies, and most of our customers are companies, not the government directly, but most of them are the big primes. And in many cases, the big primes, their engineering team is really good, and they are very passionate about getting their project done, whether it's a rocket or a spacecraft, and, you know, getting to the launch and all that. And a lot of times the engineers are sort of at they aren't necessarily on the same page as the procurement and the contract people in the company. And so those two groups tend to kind of tussle with each other about who's really running the program. And so what works for us very effectively is if the procurement people are not paying their invoices on time, because it's almost always them, not the engineers.
Uh-huh.
And we call the engineers and we say, hey, your procurement people aren't paying on time. How about you just send your hardware back to us and then we'll be square. And then we'll just call it a day. And we'll get our hardware back and then you guys can keep your money. And for the engineer, that's like killing their program. And so magically, the problem solves itself in about 2 or 3 days. So that's something we've learned, is that sometimes you can play the two groups off of each other and, you know, at least try to educate each group on how the other group works, because many times they don't understand each other. And we get stuck in the middle of that all the time. We spend way too much time working with these large aerospace company so-called supplier management systems. They have very elaborate software systems. Some of them are even semi-automated. And they are not well tailored for small businesses like us, but we're spending way too much time just dealing with those processes. So I think anybody that's thinking about getting into small business like this, you need to really appreciate who your customers are going to be, how they treat small businesses, and how you can kind of tool up to deal with that.
If you have a small business as a customer, do they do things differently? Are they more responsive in paying?
Yeah, generally they are. And generally the contracting process is a lot more streamlined. So I remember in 2007 we got our biggest contract ever with another small space company, and it was by far our biggest contract by that time, you know, many hundreds of thousands of dollars. And the whole thing happened after a 2.5-hour face-to-face meeting and a 4-page contract that came about a week later. And we executed well on it. They loved what we did. Super simple. In other cases, from some of the big primes, literally to get like a $25,000 contract, we have to wade through 5 or 6 documents that might add up to 100 pages or more, and sign all sorts of forms and fill out all sorts of forms. And it's just completely the opposite process. I know a lot of these primes are doing it because the government imposes all these rules on them, because they're, you know, major government suppliers and all that, but it is very tedious.
Well, maybe some of that will change if they get rid of some of the regulations for business,
yeah.
But don't hold your breath very hard.
But when you step back from it all, what it means for companies like us, when you're dealing with these large organizations, many of these primes have major divisions in different states. You know, they're all over the place. And we treat each one of those major divisions of those companies as separate customers, because their processes are different in many cases. But one thing that we've noticed over the years is that when these companies, the bigger companies, impose their supplier management systems on you, in many cases, the net result is the accountability on the part of the large company gets diffused. And so really, you get a feeling like sometimes nobody's really responsible for the process. And so you can get passed around between different divisions of the company, different groups. No one really seems to have a crisp answer on what your questions are. No one seems to really be able to solve your problem. And it ultimately takes sometimes the buyer, who just really likes you as a company and they want to do well for you, they'll solve your problem somehow. But if you don't have somebody that's your champion inside these large companies, it can be a nightmare trying to navigate their systems. And We've been around long enough. We do have champions in each of our major company divisions and all that. So we have people that can help. But it's pretty amazing how the accountability is diffused when you start relying on a software system. It was so bad that we never could find a human being to talk to. It was always that you had to send an email to a computer, and then someday later, a person might get back with you in a different state. But we didn't have a person we could call to fix a silly problem. It was really just an entry error in their system. So, very frustrating to have to spend so much time on stuff like that.
You have a note from Karen in Seattle, and she says, why do you then do business with these companies? Are they the only ones that you can contract with? Do the primes have the majority of the market?
Well, for what we've decided to do, yes. We're on rockets and spacecraft. There's only so many rocket suppliers, and there's only so many spacecraft builders. And so those, when you add all those up, those are probably 80% of our business, is my guess. A very large part of our business comes from those primes. So, our large customers are Northrop Grumman, Orbital ATK, all the different divisions of Lockheed, so on and so on. And so you have to deal with them, or you have to redefine your business to address other customers. But for what we do, that's the nature of our business, so that's who we have to deal with. The problem is it's still a very, what we call, lumpy business, which means the production rates aren't very high. We talked about that before the break. We're lucky to get an order for six of our systems at once. That's a big order. Most of the time it's one or two. And so it's really hard to get any sort of a recurring routine process going when the production rates are so low. It's not like a medical device company that might be building thousands of things, or car companies or even aircraft companies that build hundreds a month or whatever. It's just a different model. So you have to really, for all of our contracts, we have to really pay attention to what the deliverables are, when the what qualifies as an acceptable delivery for the customer, from their point of view. We have to nail that so that when we send the stuff to them, they approve it, and they get an invoice for that. They send us a payment 30 days later. That sort of thing. We have to watch every one of those, and that's what we keep track of every week, is are these things on track or not? Because if you let two or three, we're a small company, we have 14 contracts. If you let two or three of those contracts, or those companies behind those contracts, all it takes is two or three of them not paying their invoice for a month or two, and you could go out of business because you'll run out of cash. It's that bad. So you have to be really careful. One way we've insulated against that is that we purposely, from day one, have tried to make sure, if you trace where the money actually comes from for these contracts, we want it to be a fairly even mix between the commercial companies, commercial customers, civil funding, which is generally NASA in our case, and then the defense-oriented funding, which is, Air Force, National Reconnaissance Office, DARPA, that sort of thing. And so even though probably 98% of all of our contracts to date have been through companies, if you trace where the money actually comes from, it's really more like 40% DOD, maybe 30% NASA, and maybe 30% commercial. And a little bit of nonprofit in there, like the Planetary Society. But that's one way to balance this all out, so that if the government goes squirrely on you, at least maybe you have your customers from commercial side left over. That happened to us once. Probably the closest we came to going out of business was in 2013, which wasn't that long ago. But we thought it was going to be our best year ever from everything we could tell. And then the sequestration nonsense started at the federal level with the fiscal cliff and Congress not being able to make up their mind on what they're going to cut. So instead they just cut across the board all programs, and two programs we were within 2 weeks of starting, very nice programs, got completely canceled. The entire program did. They were both spacecraft programs. And all the other programs that we were hoping to get new business from got delayed because, something like 70% of all of our new business was expected to be coming from government funding. And so we went for about 8 months with not a single new contract. And that was all because of the government dysfunction, and had nothing to do with our execution, nothing to do with our strategy, really. It was just 'cause, and that was very painful. So, especially for companies that are strictly space companies, there's a lot of them propping up, seems like one a month. You hear about another one. You have to be really careful and focused about what you're trying to do, who you think your customer base is, how stable you think that is, and try to build your business around some sense of robustness. It's really hard to do, but it's just essential.
I have another question for you. Jan is in Berkeley, and Jan says, I'm graduating from Berkeley in the summer, and I have a joint degree with business and engineering, and I'm thinking of starting up my own company with a specific bent toward an aerospace product that I don't want to talk about right now. My question is, I hear lots of things about not doing this in California because it's really a hostile and expensive business environment, especially for small businesses, yet you seem to be doing okay in your part of Southern California. Would you advise a startup in aerospace to go out of California, or do you think it matters?
Well, for space-related businesses, I think what's more important than which state you're in is where are you going to get your talent, because it all depends on your management team and your technical team, and you're not going to find that in, throw out a random place, northern Montana, or you're probably not going to find it in central Iowa. But you will find people that you need like that in Southern California, in the Bay Area, around the Boulder-Denver area, around Houston, by the Space Center in Alabama, over in Virginia.
Austin, Texas has that kind of talent, too.
Austin, Austin's building up some capability. There's some along the Space Coast in Florida, a little bit in Boston and, various pockets. But there aren't that many places where you can get an ecosystem of space people. And so, to me, that's where you want to first put your pin on the map. There's less than 10 places where you want to do that. And I think especially the Bay Area right now and all through Southern California, some of them down in San Diego even, there's some pretty good talented people, both management and technical, and I think those options outweigh the regulations related to the state
and the expenses of doing something in the state.
Yeah, I mean I'm sure we could quantify how much extra it costs us to operate here versus say Arizona, but it's never a consideration. We don't really think it's such a big deal. So. It kind of depends on whether your product is maybe going to be firing rocket engines over the canyon or whether it's just a hardware product that gets produced in a building, but we don't make it a huge consideration on which state we're in.
And you're only in California. You're in two locations in California,
right.
Correct?
Right. And I think even investors, when they look at companies for consideration for investment, almost all the investors look at the management team and the technical team first, the people, not the state they're in, not what they're actually doing, or not what market they're serving, but it's who are the people that are behind the company. That's what they look at first. So you got to go where there's good people.
So for Jan, make people, getting quality people your priority,
yeah.
Is what you would say.
Yeah, and... I like to follow how investment groups evaluate companies because it's interesting how they think, and almost all of them will say they look at the management team first. A lot of them will say that they look at the capitalization of the company and just their overall financial wherewithal second. Then they look at the markets they're serving and whether they believe there is a market for whatever they're trying to do in that market. And then they finally look at the product or the service they're trying to supply to that market. It's kind of almost backwards to how a lot of engineers think about what they're doing. So I think that's fascinating that almost backwards. And I think what's probably going to be fatal is if you think you have a cool idea or a cool widget or a cool product or a cool service, but you don't understand your market, you don't understand where you're going to really monetize whatever you're doing or how you're going to do that, you can't even make the calculations on how you're going to get revenue from that, and then you don't have the right team behind it. That's a fatal mistake. And unfortunately, that's a lot of engineers that I've run into in my career. That's how they think, is that, wouldn't this be cool to do? And that's not really how you need to start. So as an example, our investor, who is still our chairman, a great guy, he's a billionaire, and he just is a closet space nut. He's probably one of the first billionaires to get involved with funding a small space company, well before Bezos and before Paul Allen and before Elon Musk was even a billionaire. This was back in 2001. He was a solid business guy, and when he challenged us to start this company, he gave us four really crisp directives, which is what we answered in 3 weeks. And I like to relay these to anybody that's thinking about it, because I think it's good advice. His first challenge, he says, tell me what you're going to do as a company in a single sentence that my grandmother will understand. No mumbo-jumbo. No acronyms, no uncertain terms, just something really simple. What are you going to do that I can explain to my grandmother in a single sentence? And the second challenge was, after you've told me what that is, tell me what the first product is or first service is in that category that you're going to try to produce and describe that. And then the third thing is, give me a letter from another CEO of another company that says, if you build this or supply this service, I will buy one. And show me that letterhead, show me that signed letter with his letterhead or her letterhead, and show me that letter. And then the fourth thing was, make sure you have a really good financial guy in your team that just talks dollars and cents and balance sheets and all that, because that's all this guy really understood anyway. And so in 3 weeks, we iterated around and finally answered all four of those questions to his satisfaction, and that's what caused him to invest in the company. But that first one is really hard. If you step back and think about it, it's really hard to do, especially as engineers and technical people. It's easy for mumbo-jumbo to sneak in and muddle the waters. So,
since you listen to all the space shows, you hear me all the time tell listeners to be succinct and to the point, right? And maybe 1% are. They simply can't even ask a question succinctly.
It's fun to do if you're into that kind of thing, but it's really a challenge. And so ours now is boiled down to we do space avionics and sensor systems. But my grandmother would probably say, well, what's an avionics? She doesn't know what that is.
Or what's a sensor system, yeah.
Yeah. So yeah. You kind of have to draw a line somewhere. But one example I just love this one, and it's really clever, and it's the way that entire operation called FedEx describes themselves. And, it's a huge company, billion-dollar company for sure.
Uh-huh.
Global company, they many years ago bought Kinko's, which was sort of the office print.
Copy machine, all that, yeah.
So they merged those together. So how does FedEx describe their company in one single sentence that my grandmother will understand? It's just four words. They say, copy, print, pack, ship. Boom. That's it. That's what they do. And I really like that one. That's clever. So that's an example. But I sort of have a small list that I keep of clever sayings like that.
I can tell you that I get on the order of between two and maybe three new space type of business proposals sent to me a week wanting to be on the space show.
Yep.
And some have a website, and some will say they haven't developed it yet. I, after reading what they tell me, I still don't know what they're doing.
Yeah.
And
that's one of my litmus tests when I look into a new business, is I try to find that one-liner that describes what
well,
they're all about.
And then if I ask them to clarify, they don't clarify.
Yeah.
And if I ask them what... you know, what's behind their technology and all that, they can't disclose it at this time.
Yeah, right.
So we don't get very far. I do typically answer all of these emails, which maybe I could save some time if I didn't do it. But, yeah, being able to be succinct and to the point, including asking questions, is really fundamental. And it is hard because, as I said, maybe 1% of the people that communicate on the show are able to do that.
Yeah, it's a real, you know, it's got some art to it. Another one I like is Google. You know, everybody knows who Google is. What is their one-liner? And if you kind of look into it, it basically boils down into they want to organize the world's information. That's kind of how they started, and that's what they're still doing, basically. So, all sorts of examples. But so that was one that really, I think that's one reason our startup phase was so smooth, is because the guidelines for what we were trying to start was so crisp. They were so crisp that we answered them crisply, and that focused the company right off the get-go. So a corollary to that is something I heard in one of those new space business plan competitions many years ago when I was involved with planning those. And one of the little packets of wisdom passed down from some experienced investors to these emerging entrepreneurs was that more startups die from indigestion than starvation. I think that's very true, too, that I think it's more likely you'll get in trouble as a small business by trying to do too much too soon and spreading yourself too thin rather than being too focused on just one or two things. I think it's much better to focus and get started and then diversify and not try to do too much or be the end-all for everybody. I see that a lot, too, in some of the startups that I...
You have another email from our friend Bijan, who's in Sweden.
Bijan, yes.
Yeah. What do you think about the new term market for launching small sats, and will it be dominated by secondary payload on large launchers or by dedicated small launchers or maybe both?
I think there's a market for both where a lot of these small sats, especially the ones connected to focused companies, they really do need the orbit that they want. They can't just take any orbit. So, you know, call it a polar sun synchronous orbit or a certain LEO orbit. A lot of these companies, their business plans depend on getting into the right orbit. So those sorts of companies are going to supply, or they're going to create the market demand for some of these small launchers that are focused on servicing them and putting their spacecraft exactly where they want to be. There's other small sat projects and programs that aren't as picky about which orbit they end up in, and so they can sort of still do the old-style secondary payload sort of ride and kind of end up with whatever orbit they end up in, you know, as long as it fits roughly what they need. And those are for, like, tech demo missions. Many of those fit that category. Or, you know, just proof-of-concept missions. A lot of these things that have come off space station through NanoRacks are kind of proof of concept demonstrators. They only last 5 or 6 or 8 months or whatever. And those are fine, but so there's demand for both. One of the new concepts that wasn't around 5 years ago was companies buying entire rockets, you know, larger rockets, and just completely loading them up with secondary payloads, basically. That's like what Space Flight Services is doing. And that's kind of a new model that I think has some market as well. So I think there's those three categories for getting into Earth orbit. And then I'm very optimistic that over the next decade or so, there will be a fourth market opening up where you're hitching a ride with other spacecraft going beyond Earth orbit to the moon and asteroids and Mars and wherever. And small sats and CubeSats will be hitching rides with those missions as well. That's a great way to get some small missions done for very low cost compared to just dedicating a rocket to them.
And you think that's about a 10-year timeline to see that starting to happen?
Yeah, it'll be happening soon, you know, probably in the next few years. Even on Mars 2020, I think there's a plan Well, I should say, on Mars InSight, there was a plan to launch two CubeSats to Mars as ride-along packages. Those were those Marco spacecraft.
Right.
But that mission got delayed, so that might be the first one. It's now going in 2018. But that's an example of what I'm talking about. And there's been a few little bits and pieces of that already with lunar missions. You know, like you mentioned Celestis as one of your sponsors.
Right.
They had a small package on Lunar Prospector that went, you know, with Eugene Shoemaker's ashes on it. And that's an example of what I'm talking about.
Yeah, we've done that spot a lot last year.
And so I'm a big fan of that sort of thing, just taking advantage of those rides going out there. But all that being said, I mentioned earlier there's something like 30 different projects underway to try to address these markets with small launch vehicle capability or secondary payload accommodations, you know, whatever it is. I think in about 5 years, there might only be 10 of those left. I think most of them are going to dry up on the vine and go out of business. There's just not enough market for all of those.
Well, there might even be less than 10.
Yeah, there might be less. I think there'll be, you know, if it's like any other fairly maturing market, there's going to be two or three pretty solid competitors that probably have 70 or 80% of the market, and then there's the also-rans, you know, the other four or five that have their little piece. But there will probably be two or three or four fairly stable, very competitive, well-run companies that are dominating all that. Another thing I should mention, once you get started and you have your focus as a company and you've figured out what market you're serving and you've got some customers, is you always have to polish off your company statement and, you know, make sure that fits what you're trying to do, that simple statement, and connect all your branding to that. You know, make sure that's what you're selling out there so people remember that. And if you slack off and let it go stale, I think you can sometimes end up being forgotten. That's important. One thing we learned here is that we didn't think through well enough how we're going to scale our business up, you know, and that leads to growth if you can scale it up. And eventually that gives you options for how you're going to exit and all that. It turns out the Rocket Camp business is not a very scalable business because there's only so many rockets and only so many spacecraft. Even worldwide, that's the case. And so there's a cap on how much we can do to address that market. It's not an unlimited infinitely scalable business. Unlike a lot of internet applications where if you do things right, you can potentially have billions of customers. And it's just not the case in space. So I know a lot of the investors think this through pretty carefully, and that's why they're investing in some companies versus others, is that they think they're a scalable company. I think that I wish we would have thought that through a lot more carefully when we started, because it's a hard thing to think through and to execute on. But if you don't have a story there, then it's sort of self-limiting. So that's something I fully appreciate now after 16 years. The growth part is pretty hard just because of what we're doing. That's why we're diversifying, because that gives us other places to grow into.
So having multiple sources of income is pretty essential from what I'm hearing you say.
Yeah, I mentioned earlier that, we made the right move early on to go after commercial, civil, and defense funding. And I think that's a big reason that we're still alive now, but that doesn't by itself lead to growth. What you need for growth is scalability. Somehow you need to start just adding more customers or multiplying the production runs of these things. And that's been hard to do just because there's only so many customers, so many projects, and there aren't that many production orders. So for a while, we looked at, you know, we were trying to somehow adapt our product family to onboard video on commercial airliners, for example, because they built hundreds of those. And we looked at adapting them to back when police, worn cameras on police groups, you know, was a big topic about 5 years ago. And we thought, well, maybe we could generate some business by adapting our video systems for use in that arena. But there are like a dozen different places we looked at that all could have used some sort of rugged video system. But it turns out there were competitors in all of those markets, already established, already doing production runs. Their prices were already low. And, you know, our stuff was over-designed because it's built for rockets and spacecraft, so it just didn't really fit any of those markets. UAVs was another one, you know, unmanned aerial vehicles.
Right.
And it's just amazing how many other companies are out there in those markets. And so we finally gave up on all of them and just focused back on space again. And that's when we decided to just create some new product lines and get into some new lines of business with those same customers. It just expands a little bit from there. So it's really interesting to try to grow your business and diversify your business. It's a real challenge, and that's what we're having fun with now is how to do that. We've kind of got the nuts and bolts down of how to get work done and how to invoice the work and how to collect it. But selling new work to new customers and new products and all that is the challenge. So I mentioned before, most of our contracts are with other companies, not with the government, even though probably when you trace the money, it actually probably 70% of it comes from the government. But we find as a small business, most of the primes are very good at dealing with the government, and they get the big contracts for the rocket or the spacecraft or whatever, or dealing with commercial companies even. You know, the spacecraft manufacturers deal with their customers who want to buy a commercial geo satellite, for example. And so we operate pretty well when we let the primes deal with all of that and get the basic contract in place, and then we become a supplier to them. So this company-to-company relationship works a whole lot better for us than us having to figure out how to deal with the government. And that's not to say we haven't had government contracts. We've had probably a dozen out of, I think we're up to almost 320 contracts now that we've had, and maybe a dozen have been directly with government agencies, but we find working with other companies works a lot better for us.
Going to be approaching the end of the show soon. What do you shift us to what you see for 2017 trends? What do you think the year is going to look like for new space, commercial space, kinds of space activities?
Yeah, I'm really excited and have been for a few years because I've been in the space business my entire career, coming up on 39 years this June. And I think it's the most exciting time of my whole career right now with what's going on. And I pointed out to you, David, when I sent you my updated bio and all that, that over my career I've been involved with a lot of these, some of the early starts of a lot of these trends, you know, for years, you know, small sats and commercial space and commercial deep space and, you know, commercial crew and all sorts of things. And so it's really nice to see all of these things starting to happen. But the things I'm following, which I'm really excited about, and all these will have things, very important things happening this year, are this entire launch vehicle arena. You know, we talked about small launch vehicles tailored to small sats and CubeSats. We talked about large rockets coming online that will service different markets, you know, the Falcon Heavy. You know, companies buying entire rockets and loading them up with small sats. There's this whole trend toward reusable rockets that's just on fire right now with SpaceX and Blue Origin. And that's terribly exciting. And then just watching the effect SpaceX is having on the entire rocket industry is really interesting to me. And, you know, they're shaking up the entire industry because of what they're doing. So I follow that closely. I've always been interested in small sats since 85, and that's really blossoming now. Small sats, CubeSats, everything's going crazy. I like the business side of that, you know, trying to figure out why these small satellites can justify a business, and then a lot of the technology is really interesting, too. So I follow all of that, and I tend to go to the small sat conferences. There's two or three that are really interesting that cover all the bases for me, so I go to all of those. constellations are back again. They were big in the late 90s and early 2000s, and they're back again. Front page news most weeks. We got Planet just apparently is in the process of acquiring the Terabella constellation from Google, which surprised me. I'm not sure what's going on there. I hope to learn more next week at a conference up there. But that's an interesting development. Iridium just started launching their replacement constellation for the original Iridium constellation. They had 10 satellites on the last Falcon launch, and that's interesting. OneWeb is, they're getting ready to produce up to 700 satellites for another constellation that could revolutionize global access to the Internet. That's terribly exciting. And SpaceX is also talking about doing something similar, only with many more satellites than 700. And we'll see if that pans out or not. There's even constellations being proposed that are not imaging satellites, not comm satellites, but like radar satellites. Miniature radar satellites, that's pretty interesting. I've been a big fan and promoter of commercial deep space ventures for the last 20 years and been actively involved with three companies that were trying to do that, and some of that action is still alive. The Google Lunar X Prize was mentioned. That all comes to a head this year, and my own personal opinion is I think only one team has a chance at winning the prize.
You want to name it?
I think the Space Isle people from Israel might have a shot at it.
Wow, I would have thought you would have said Moon Express.
Just from what I know, that's the only one I think has a shot at it. But
what's it called? What's the Israeli team called?
Space IL.
Okay, for Israel, that's their international term.
Yeah, and they have a firm launch on an Indian rocket, is it Indian or is it a Falcon?
No, I think it's an Indian rocket, but I'm not 100% sure, but I think it
is. Anyway, but they have a good, solid team. I understand they have pretty good funding, and I think the spacecraft and mission design is well thought out, and they just seem to be the leader to me. But that's one mission that's going. It'll be decided or not this year. I know all the people that started Deep Space Industries and Planetary Resources, and they're making progress on what they're trying to do, although that's a much longer term prospect. But they're properly couching their business with interim milestones so they can keep going, and that's interesting to me.
I was recently asked to do an Esquire magazine interview on deep space resource usage and mining, and it's so far out there that it's not a big thing of interest to me. I'm more focused on things that are closer in. Maybe that's because I'm getting older. I don't know. But I did comment in the interview that I thought both companies had really outstanding management and executive teams that could manage the risk and the times and the timelines and all of that on the way to their intended victories, if I can use that word. And I said, if it's possible for these companies to become commercial and make a ton of money and do what they say they're going to do, I think they have good management in place to help them get there. And that's about the most that I can say about it.
Yes, it's interesting to watch. I was paying attention when they first came on the radar screen, and you may have heard Daniel Faber, the CEO of Deep Space Industries, recently left, apparently on good terms. And I talked to him a few days after that news release came out and asked him what's up. And he's always been interested in this topic of accessing the resources of the solar system. And he's actually leaving to try to build up the market demand for that service. He did what he could do to build up a company to actually produce this stuff, but he feels like he could add more value by helping to build up the perception of a market, and I think that's a good move. Like you say, if there is a market, it seems like it's way out there. But I'm a huge fan of trying to access the resources of the solar system for the future of civilization. So it's a really interesting topic. It's a long-term topic, but it's really interesting to me. Another one is, we've talked many times, you have on your show endlessly, about when is routine space tourism or routine access to space on some of these commercial vehicle is going to happen, and that's, you know, every year progresses a little bit. So, you know, maybe we'll see Virgin Galactic get closer to having passengers on their vehicle by the, you know, early next year, and maybe we'll get WorldView to have their balloons up in the stratosphere so people can go up there, and maybe we'll have more paying passengers going up to space station someday or on a Dragon capsule, who knows, but that's worth following. And then finally, I like to, for all these things, I like to follow what the investors are thinking and what they're saying and finding out who's going out of business, who's consolidating by getting acquired, you know, all that stuff. That's important because there's the next 5 years, all these companies we're talking about have to either perform or they're going to go out of business or get acquired or something.
But right.
They're not all going to be around in 5 years, so I like to find out that landscape, too. It's just fun to follow. What I don't, what I can't say much on is what Trump's going to do, who's going to run NASA, you know, what NASA's going to do, what Congress is going to do. Anybody can say what they want about that. I'm not going to project anything.
That's here. Right. Take
it
your pick.
It sounds like a lot of chaos before anything settles down.
Yeah, I think there is a lot of chaos going on,
and
for sure.
And kind of out of the corner of my eye, I like to try to follow some general trends from Russia, especially from your guest, routine guest, Anatoly Zak. You know, I'd love to hear what he has to say about what's going on there. And same with China, Japan, and India. You know, they all have active space programs that are in various states of evolution. But China's kind of on the upswing. Japan's been having some trouble lately, and India's shown some really good capabilities. I just hope that they can keep it up, especially things like their first Mars mission was a success. That's pretty amazing to me. And even the United Arab Emirates is trying to build up a space capability, and they're pouring all sorts of money and talent into it. They're worth watching. So anyway, there's so much going on, it's hard to keep track of it all.
But well, yeah. that means you'll have to come back on and tell us how you kept track and how well your those things that you're following, you know, performed or did not perform.
Yeah, there's so many interesting developments in all these areas happening almost on a weekly basis that this year, next year, the year after should just be stellar in terms of development. Terrific.
So you don't see any possibility for the regulatory environment to crack down and try to stop or slow down or hinder anything going on in commercial and new space?
Yeah, if anything, I might read the tea leaves and say that maybe for the next 4 years we'll get a slight course correction more toward commercial models than government models, but beyond that, you know, who knows? I would like to hope something good will happen, but I'm sort of the eternal pessimist about that sort of thing.
Anything that we should have talked about or that we've forgotten to ask you that's been omitted that you wanted to be sure to talk to listeners about today? Because we're pretty much at the end of the point for the show, so.
Yeah, well, we didn't mention, I know it's Friday and most people can't call, but if anybody wanted to ask a question later by email, maybe they could go to your blog and I'll check your blog.
Yeah, they can post comments when you get to the archive audience, post comments, but Friday morning's not a big show morning for phone calls. It's pretty good for email, but not for phone calls.
Yeah, so I guess if people have questions, why don't you just send them to your blog, David, and I'll make sure I check there.
Yeah, and I make sure guests see the feedback coming in on the blog, too. But you usually check it anyway because you listen to the show, so you'll probably see it before I send you the notes.
Yeah, I listen to almost all of your shows, so that's a good source of information for me.
Are you going to SmallSat this year in Utah?
Yeah, actually, I'm going to hit three conferences. I alluded to them earlier, but one is next week up in the Bay Area called the SmallSat Symposium. I believe it's their third one. It's in it's at the Computer Museum in Mountain View next to Google.
Uh-huh.
And that's where a lot of the business and investor and insurance people and the providers of SmallSat services and products all come together. It's very business-oriented. And not as much technical, but more business. You know, what's the business case for these things? And that's a good one. I'm going to go to that. In May, there's the International Small Satellite Conference. I'm sorry, Interplanetary Small Satellite Conference, which tends to address the small sats and CubeSats going beyond Earth orbit, which is a topic I'm really...
Where is that held?
It tends to bounce around between the Bay Area and Southern California. This year, it's at San Jose State University.
Huh.
Usually when it's down here, it's at Caltech. And that's where all the folks that are doing CubeSats and small sats that go beyond Earth orbit are.
That might be interesting for me to try to attend.
Yeah, you should. It's really, it's all the right people. And
do you have the...
It's like how SmallSat and Logan used to be when it was small, but now SmallSat is 1,500 people or whatever.
Right,
we are going to that. And that's my favorite conference every year. So.
Do you have the URL for the interplanetary one that you can email me?
Yeah, I will.
Please do.
Yeah,
and then SmallSat and Logan.
Yeah, and then SmallSat and Logan. And then I go to other conferences that are related to some of our other business spaces. But in terms of SmallSats, that's what I go to.
Will you be doing AIAA in Orlando this year?
I haven't decided yet.
Yeah, I would like to go. I'm on the fence still, too. And I am doing the Space Foundation Symposium since they wanted me to chair a panel discussion. So I am going to be there for the first time ever at the Space Foundation meeting.
Yeah, that's a good one. I'm probably going to go to that this year as well.
Well, I may or may not see you there. I understand there's so many thousands of people there, it's hard to find.
Oh, you have to arrange ahead of time where you're going to meet because you won't run into people otherwise, unless it's totally random.
Well, I will be there, and I am at the Broadmoor, so hopefully we'll arrange and get to visit, and I'll see you.
Yeah, and I should mention, for anybody that's actually going to be at the SmallSat Symposium next week in Mountain View, which is there's a workshop scheduled Monday, and then the conference is Tuesday and Wednesday. If they want to try to meet me, just contact me.
Yeah.
On your website for this show, David, do you have my contact email or not?
Well, I don't usually disclose it for people because I don't want spammers to pick it up.
But why don't they send a message to your website?
But if you guys want to reach Rex, email me, and I'll forward your note to Rex. And if you want to arrange to be able to text him or all of that, just send me your information. I'll make sure he gets it.
Yeah, and then I have most of Thursday and Friday morning next week available up there, too, where, you know, as long as you're fairly close to NASA Ames or thereabouts or Google, I could probably arrange a meeting.
Okay.
Be happy to.
All right. Well, I look forward to seeing you at some of these events later in the year, and I thank you for being back on the show. I look forward to talking to you again, and I'll get all the archive information to you either tonight or in the morning when I get the show archived, and look forward to talking to you again down the road.
Sure, maybe end of the year, early next year again.
Whenever you're ready to give us some updates, absolutely.
Okay, very good.
Thank you, and listeners, that's it. And so then come back on Sunday for our Sunday Space Show program. We have a full thing for you all next week as well. So everybody have a great week. It might be a little wet one in California, but keep it dry. And as we say, keep looking up. Thanks from Rex and David and the Space Show. Goodbye, everybody.